Bolton as they try and engineer regime change in a country that they don't understand, don't care about, and only want to exploit.
And the significance of them having as a partner Bolsonaro, the new far-right former army captain, the president of Brazil.
Yeah, I mean, usually what happens in these kinds of cases is there's at least an attempt made to make liberals feel good about what the real motives are. You know, we're going to change the regime in Libya, not because we care about the oil, but because we just want to help the Libyan people be liberated from this bad dictator, the same with Iraq, you know, pulling babies out of incubators. There's at least an attempt made. And here, there's barely an attempt made. It's all very explicit and blatant. And the fact that the leading U.S. partner in Latin America to do this is Jair Bolsonaro should tell you everything you need to know about what the real motives are in terms of what the U.S. government is trying to accomplish in Venezuela. It's nothing good for the Venezuelan people, no matter what your view of Nicolas Maduro is. It's all about imposing a far-right ideology for the benefit of everybody but the Venezuelan people.
Glenn Greenwald, we want to thank you for being with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, one of the founding editors of The Intercept. Thanks so much. We will link to your pieces in The Intercept. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, February 11th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, a documentary filmed at two concerts celebrating Chuck Berry's 60th birthday. Again, that's Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, showing Monday, February 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KABU Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KABU member listeners and support from Portland 5 Centers for the Arts, presenting traditional Irish folk band The Chieftains, February 20th at the Newmark Theater. Tickets and more information online at portland5.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a Denver teacher strike,
Trump's shutdown negotiation,
and in international news, a global insect decline.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, February 11th, 2019. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Listeners, please note, we have a trigger warning. This next story references police brutality and violence. Two dozen Democrats in the Oregon House are demanding an apology from a Republican state senator who blamed a black man's death at the hands of New York City police on tobacco taxes. Senator Dennis Linthicum from Klamath Falls sent out a press release last Thursday criticizing a proposal to raise the state tax on cigarettes by about 77 cents per pack. The release was headlined, quote, "I can't breathe. Tax hikes might be death sentences." It blamed the 2014 death of Eric Garner on what he called disproportionate and abusive state power. Garner died 5 years ago after being choked by officers attempting to stop him from selling individual cigarettes on a street corner. Garner's execution was caught on video, and he said, "I can't breathe" 11 times before he died from asphyxiation. In their letter, 24 House Democrats demanded an explanation and apology from Linthicum. They point out that Mr. Garner's death did not occur because he was selling cigarettes. It occurred because of police brutality, a lack of accountability, and the systemic racism that exists within our country. Linthicum's spokesman defended the press release Thursday, contending that Garner was selling cigarettes on a Staten Island sidewalk because New York tobacco taxes led to an illegal market for tobacco products, thus leading to the encounter with police. That's an argument Garner's wife has made publicly, and that has been seized on by some anti-tax conservatives.
Teachers in Denver are on strike today, and thousands of students and parents have joined them in a walkout in support of their demands. Teacher strikes have been successful in Los Angeles, West Virginia, Vancouver, Washington, and a number of other places around the country in recent months. The walkout comes after more than 15 months of tense negotiations between the school district and the teachers' union. Teachers say their salaries are too low for Denver's high cost of living and aren't keeping up with pay in neighboring districts. Denver has relied on a pay-for-performance model that began last year and has led to wide variations in pay, but Denver teachers remain among the lowest paid in the country. City and state officials tried to stop the teachers from striking by threatening them with jail time, but as of today, more than 2,000 teachers are now picketing in the streets.
Today is a crucial day for lawmakers in Washington to negotiate with the Trump White House to reach a deal before Friday's deadline leads to another government shutdown. The previous shutdown, which lasted 35 days and ended on January 25th, was the longest in U.S. history. If a new agreement is not reached by both the House of Representatives and the Senate, and signed by the President, a partial government shutdown will begin on Saturday. As Trump continues to push for a border wall, more horror stories have emerged this week, showing how disorganized and chaotic this past year's family separation has been. Immigration officials reported that orders came from above with no plan to track families that were separated. Meanwhile, airport workers who were left without pay in December and January are gearing up for the possibility of another Trump shutdown. They've organized protests in more than 80 cities across the country. If Trump refuses to budge and forces the government to close again on Saturday.
On Saturday, Donald Trump made what appeared to be a joke about the Trail of Tears in a tweet criticizing Senator Elizabeth Warren. He also revived the racist trope of calling her Pocahontas. The Trail of Tears was a horrific period in U.S. history in which the government forced Native people to march hundreds of miles in a genocidal forced relocation march from the East Coast to west of the Mississippi. But the corporate media have largely ignored Trump's racist mockery of the genocide, instead criticizing freshman Congressman Ilhan Omar for pointing out in a tweet the undue influence of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee on Congress. Trump teased Elizabeth Warren in his tweet, asking if she would be the first Native American candidate for president. While Warren has made it clear that she herself is not a Native American, there have been Native American candidates for the office in the past. Robert Latham Owen, a registered member of the Cherokee Nation, ran for president in 1920. Winona LaDuke of the Mendota tribe ran for vice president with Ralph Nader in 1996 and 2000. And Charles Curtis of the Kaw and Potawatomi tribes served as U.S. vice president from 1929 to 1933.
We're highlighting Black excellence to honor Black History Month on the KBOO News. Today, we bring you a story from St. Louis, Missouri, where a family moved from wanting their three Black children to feel proud of their heritage to wanting all Black kids to feel proud and represented. So Jeffrey and Pamela Blair decided to open a bookstore, I See Me. It's a 1,200 square foot storefront on the St. Louis suburb of University City, featuring African American and African authors. The Blairs have curated close to 3,000 titles, ranging from Africa-themed alphabets to the lives of Black inventors to hip-hop poetry. Collectively, they chronicle African-American lives, history, and culture. I See Me says to its young customers, "Do you see all these stories of achievement, of courage, of ingenuity, of fun? This is who you are." The Blairs began their work by publishing games that challenged players to create timelines of African-Americans in history, in an effort to understand the connections among significant events. They also created posters celebrating contributions by African Americans and brought them to the kids' school. They talked to administrators about teaching more books with African American perspective, and then they opened their own bookstore. Although the Blairs are more humanists than activists, race has long been an incendiary issue in St. Louis. The Dred Scott case was first tried at the old courthouse here, and ICME is locally located 5 miles from Ferguson, where in 2014, a white police officer killed a young African-American man named Michael Brown, inspiring the Black Lives Matter movement.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast, dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The president of the National Congress of American Indians, Jefferson Keel, delivered the State of Indian Nations address from Washington, D.C. Monday morning. Keel began his speech saying tribes are resilient and are working to better their nations. He highlighted the 2018 midterm elections and Native Americans elected to local, state, and national offices. Keel went on to talk about what he said are threats to Indian country, including calling on the Trump administration to halt the reorganization of the Interior Department and to create an Undersecretary of Indian Affairs. He says more needs to be done to address climate change, saying tribes face threats to their land, hunting, and fishing. Keel called on the administration and Congress to keep trust and treaty responsibilities, saying the recent government shutdown hurt tribes.
To the United States government, I promise that NCAI will be there every step of the way, partnering with you and holding you accountable, just as we have since 1944. To our elected leaders and the American people, I invite you to become Indian country's allies. Learn from us about our histories, governments, and contemporary life.
Representative Deb Holland delivered the congressional response. She highlighted Native history and culture, saying Native people have survived and are reshaping their stories and representations nationally. Holland says some of the work in Congress includes addressing violence against women through Savannah's Act, legislation to advance appropriations to protect tribes during government shutdowns, and efforts to protect Native sacred sites such as Chaco Canyon and Bears Ears from development.
My promise to you is that I will work hard to carry our voices in Congress to help weave a promising future for all of Indian country so that we are no longer hidden in plain view. My hope for you is that no matter where you are or what is going on in your life, that you can create beauty as long as you always remember that every day is a good day to be Indigenous.
The annual speech lays out goals and priorities for Indian country. In Montana, the president of the Fort Belknap, Assiniboine, and Grovant tribes addressed the state legislature late last week. Corin Cates Carney has more.
President Andrew Work Jr. delivered the State of Tribal Nations address to the Montana House of Representatives.
In this legislative session, I am proud to report a record number of Native Americans are serving in the interests of tribal citizens. Our Native American legislatures are an inspiration to us all and are setting a strong example for future generations.
Native Americans make up 7% of the state legislature, as well as about 7% of Montana's population. Work says the Montana Native American Caucus is focused on policy, addressing the high rate of missing and murdered Indigenous women, preventing youth suicide, preserving Indigenous languages, and chipping away at the disparity in health outcomes between tribal and non-tribal people. He says the continuation of the state's Medicaid expansion program for low-income adults is an important step. The expansion program is set to expire in June if not reauthorized by lawmakers.
Medicaid expansion is critical for improving American Indian health and health care delivery systems in Indian country.
In Montana, Native American people have a life expectancy that is about 20 years shorter than white people. Work also called on the legislature to work with tribes to give nations more flexibility managing herds of buffalo on reservations. To accomplish these goals, Work says the state of Montana and local governments need to work collaboratively with tribal nations. He says that means respecting tribal nations as sovereign and on the same level as state government. For National Native News, I'm Corin Cates Carney in Helena, Montana.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Thank you.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the new book, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, written by local author Wendy Willis. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, cloudy with periods of rain, with a low 39 degrees and winds at south-southwest at 15 to 25 miles per hour. Chance of rain, 100%, with about 1 to 2 inches of rain expected. Tomorrow's weather, rain is very likely. High, 41 degrees Fahrenheit, winds southbound at about 10 to 15 miles per hour, and another 100% chance of rain. Rainfall near half an inch. Today in Black History, first black legal protest in America took place when 11 black Americans petitioned for freedom in New Amsterdam. That is now New York. The quote of the day is from Audre Lorde. When I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of my vision, then it becomes less and less important whether I am afraid.
Portland Community College has just received a national award for reducing carbon emissions on campus. The group Second Nature helps make the principles of sustainability fundamental to every aspect of higher education. They awarded PCC a mark of distinction, which recognizes the performance, participation, and goal setting of colleges and universities to reduce harmful emissions. This award adds to the history that Portland Community College has had as a sustainability leader. In 2017, PCC earned the 2017 Climate Leadership Award from Second Nature and participated in the UN Climate Conference as a member of the We Are Still In Coalition in Bonn, Germany. In 2013, the UN University designated PCC as a regional center of expertise on education for sustainable development.
Conservation groups are cheering the introduction today of a measure to stop fossil fuel extraction in a section of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The legislation is a renewed effort by California Representative Jared Huffman. It would repeal a provision included in the GOP's 2017 tax bill that opened the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge to oil and gas exploration and drilling. The Natural Resources Defense Council said this new provision would bring back the protections of those fragile Arctic ecosystems. It would also preserve the fundamental human rights of the Gwich'in people, who have maintained this land for thousands of years. Two-thirds of all Americans oppose drilling in the Arctic Refuge. Even one season of oil drilling would disrupt nesting grounds for dozens of species of migratory birds who flock to the Arctic Refuge from every U.S. state and six continents. And even just doing seismic testing would likely cause irreparable harm to the Arctic's iconic polar bears.
A new report in the science journal Biological Conservation has found that the planet's insect populations are in a steep decline. The report clearly draws a connection between this mass extinction event and the heavy use of pesticides in agriculture. Professor Dave Golson with the University of Sussex, who helped author the report, said the insect decline could result in a catastrophic collapse of nature's ecosystems if not addressed.
The Black Agenda Report is a global news outlet that is centered on news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. Here's today's report.
Mean that we have a socialist system. After all, most of the rest of the industrial world already has such a system.
Right. And most of the non-industrial world or the developing economies, such as China and Vietnam and North Korea and probably South Korea, have that. I should also mention Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. So the United States, in terms of caring for its people and it being the responsibility ultimately of the state to care for vital needs of the people, we are an outvalue. Most people and nations in the world have accepted a form of capitalism which also recognizes that to have political and social stability. You have to provide something for the people, and you have to regulate the inherent tendencies of capitalism to produce wide inequalities. Our economic model is perhaps unique in the world in regards to not being concerned about that, and a capitalism, as Martin Luther King said, socialism for the rich and rugged individualism for the working class and poor. So we're out of touch with the trajectory of history and with humanity, which I should say, by the way, Glenn, because we do not provide those things at the level of the government, because we have this ruthless form of capitalism, it makes our nation more ripe for rebellion and even revolutionary change than would be the case in nations that provide those things, such as Sweden, such even as England or France.
Well, in terms of being out of touch, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party seem to be out of touch with the base voters. 70% and more of Americans as a whole support this slew of proposals made by Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez. We're talking about single payer, but also free college tuition. Ocasio-Cortez's proposal to raise tax rates on the rich to 70%, and of course that Green New Deal proposal, the outlines of which have been revealed already, and which call for a total overhaul of the U.S. economy, not just its industrial parts.
Yeah, the fact that they do it from within the Democratic Party, to me, indicates that these are talking points, and they will be talked to death, and that they're not serious in terms of creating the political conditions among the great mass of people. As you say, 70 and 80% of Democrats in particular support a kind of Green New Deal and universal health care without the insurance companies. But the fact that these proposals are made from within the Democratic Party and not from the standpoint of a mass movement suggests to me that they are not serious in terms of being implemented and are in the end talking points for the 2020 election and soon after that to be dropped and forgotten. So I hope you would forgive me for my skepticism. I am not cynical. I am skeptical of a group of socialists who would prefer, rather than building a socialist movement with a program to overhaul the system, are making proposals that look to be leaning in the direction of socialism from within a party that is dominated and controlled by, and in fact exists for the sake of keeping the 1% or the 1/10 of 1% or the corporate imperialists in power.
You seem to be predicting that the Democratic Party will accept these proposals that have super majorities and only dump them after the election, but accept them at the convention. Many of us think that this Democratic Party will not allow these proposals to get to the convention, and that this rejection by the party of these supermajority-backed proposals could lead to an explosion of the party and a huge defection of disgruntled leftist Democrats.
Well, this is what we're faced with. And, you know, to put it in really stark terms, the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, face crises that are existential. These parties, for the majority of people, are no longer seen as legitimate and useful in the conduct of the people's business, in the pursuance of people's democratic aspirations, be they for health care, be they for a green economy or whatever. So, I think the Democratic Party is fighting a struggle to regain some legitimacy, or to regain legitimacy as they go into the 2020 election. I don't think that these proposals are serious unless they are based upon building a movement in the industrial states, in these big cities, among the poor. I can think, as I always am thinking, about Philadelphia. Where are the mechanisms to build support for a green economy, for universal health care, and on and on and on? So that's my point. I don't think it's serious. I think the Democrats are trying to build a coalition for 2020. I think they face a real problem at their convention, because as long as they flirt with left, and I put quotes around that, of their party, and have to concede some things, at least in terms of talking points, it does suggest that there will be people who will take it seriously. And when they get to that convention and find out that, well, we could talk about these issues, but that's as far as it's going, then you might have an explosion on the floor of the Democratic Party convention. Something like you had in 2016 when they had to make the Sanders delegates invisible.
Of course, you're correct about movement politics, and we know where movement politics go during election years. And now we seem to be having a two-year election year. That is, the 2020 election year has already begun.
No question. And, you know, there's a historical precedent of sorts in the 1968 Democratic Party convention. Right now, I have to say, I don't take this left wing of the Democratic Party, including the DSA, serious. I think they want to talk issues to death, but they do not want to build the types of movements to make these talking points into policy. The other thing is, I don't consider it left unless, along with domestic proposals for reform, there is talk of cutting these huge military budgets and ending the U.S. war policies throughout the world.
And in fact, the Democratic Party went along with the Trump budget, which was even bigger than what Trump had asked for the military-industrial complex.
Absolutely, including Bernie Sanders, the most well-known socialist in the United States. So we're at the beginning of something, the end of something, and the beginning of something. I think we have to assess what is going on more clearly. I think included in any discussion of 2020 has to be the crisis of the U.S. dollar, which in many ways explains this Bolton, Pompeo, Trump.
The group Youth Against Settlements has begun accompanying Palestinian children to schools to protect them from increasing attacks by Israeli settlers and soldiers following Israel's expulsion of the city's UN observer mission. This is the Middle East Minute.
I'm Esti Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. The Israeli government has announced that it will retroactively legalize structures built on private Palestinian land in the West Bank settlement of Eliyahu Zahav. This is the first time Israel has invoked this legal mechanism following its approval by their attorney general in December. Eliyahu Zahav is an illegal settlement located close to Route 5, which links the Jewish-only settlement of Ariel with Tel Aviv, and was also built on Palestinian land, which Israel seized from the residents of two Palestinian villages in the northern West Bank district of Salfit. And Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Hebron started walking children to school on Sunday to protect them from Israeli settlers following Israel's expulsion of the city's UN observer mission. Youth Against Settlements, or YAS, began accompanying children to school wearing vests with the word observer written in English, Arabic, and Hebrew. A video showing the activists protecting a group of Palestinian schoolchildren from an attack by illegal Israeli settlers quickly went viral on social media. A spokesman for YAS said the campaign aims to afford 24-hour protection for the city's Palestinian residents and specifically its schoolchildren, noting that the Palestinians had become subject to daily attacks and aggression by Israeli settlers and the Israeli army in the absence of the temporary international presence teams in Hebron. The activists said they would work around the clock to document Israeli violations in order to expose them. Quds Press also reported that scores of settlers protected by the Israeli army attacked and insulted the activists when they started their campaign. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 11th, 2019. Here are the main points again. Denver teacher strikes, the Trump's shutdown negotiation, and in international news, a global insect decline. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. The producer is Rachel Hartley, and our engineer is Mike Fotopoulos. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Leslie McLam.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up Tuesday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joe and Abe Talk Radio discuss the issues of the day with your call-ins. At 9, Alternative Radio features Ralph Nader speaking on the unjust prosecution of those who commit crimes in the streets versus those who commit crimes in the suites. At 10 on Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein looks at breaking news issues of the day. And at 11, Stage and Studio and Art Focus make room for a special introductory broadcast of Peace, Love, and Soup with the amazing Tave Fasha Drake and Brian Delaney. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by member support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm, click on the button marked Donate, and be sure to stay tuned for our in-depth interview with Portland author Wendy Willis on her new collections of essays, These Are Strange Times, My Dear. Good night, Leslie. Good night, Mike.
Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our in-depth guest today is Wendy Willis, author of the new essay collection, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, Field Notes from the Republic from Counterpoint Press. Wendy's a Portland-based writer, poet, and lawyer. She's published two books of poetry, and her work has appeared in the New England Review, Oregon Humanities, Poetry Northwest, The Rumpus, and Ziziva. Wendy's been awarded the 2017 Dorothy Brunsman Poetry Prize, and she's a 2019 Oregon Book Awards finalist in the poetry category for her book, A Long Late Pledge. In her role as activist, Wendy is executive director of Deliberative Democracy Consortium and the founder and director of Oregon's Kitchen Table. Wendy will be reading from These Are Strange Times, My Dear, at Powell's on Hawthorne tonight at 7:30. I should mention that Wendy's married to celebrated Oregon poet David Beispiel. He'll be launching his new book of poems, Republic Cafe, next Monday, February 21st, also at Powell's on Hawthorne. We were hoping to have Wendy live with us in the studio tonight, but she's been delayed due to some weather conditions and unforeseen problems. So if Wendy comes in time, we'll be able to ask her a few questions. Just want to remind you, it's a great book. And again, she'll be at Powell's on Hawthorne tonight at 7:30. In the meantime, let's listen to Rising Up with Sonali.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kulhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, just days away from the February 15th deadline to pass a government spending bill, Congress has still not come up with a deal that Republicans and their president can agree on with the Democrats. Late last week, there were glimmers of hope that a deal was taking shape. But on Sunday, one of the central lawmakers in the bipartisan committee tasked with arriving at a deal, Republican Senator Richard Shelby, admitted that they were stalled in an interview. Among the differences that have now emerged between the two parties is disagreement on whether to limit the number of undocumented immigrants the government can detain. In the absence of a deal, Democrats plan to pass a continuing resolution in the House to fund the Department of Homeland Security and other agencies through September. Mick Mulvaney, acting White House Chief of Staff, appeared on Sunday talk shows declaring that the president was still willing to shut the government down for a second time over his demand for a border wall.
We cannot definitively rule out a government shutdown at the end of this week.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our in-depth guest today, Wendy Willis, has arrived. She's the author of the new essay collection, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, Field Notes from the Republic from Counterpoint Press. Wendy is a Portland-based writer, poet, and lawyer. She's published two books of poetry, and her work has appeared in the New England Review, Oregon Humanities, Poetry Northwest, The Rumpus, and Ziziva. I love saying Ziziva. Wendy's been awarded the 2017 Dorothy Brunsman Poetry Prize, and she's a 2019 Oregon Book Awards finalist in the poetry category for her book, A Long Late Pledge. In her role as activist, Wendy's executive director of Deliberative Democracy Consortium and the founder and director of Oregon's Kitchen Table. She'll be reading tonight from These Are Strange Times, My Dear, at Powell's on Hawthorne at 7:30 p.m. Should also mention Wendy's married to celebrated Oregon poet David Beispiel, who will be launching his new book of poems, Republic Cafe, next Monday, February 21st, also at Powell's on Hawthorne. Wendy, thanks for coming in. I know you had some trouble with the weather and parking around here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Ken. It would have been faster to walk.
Or if those scooters were still around, yeah. You know? They'll come back, I think.
Thank you.
Well, I apologize for that long intro, but you're incredibly productive as an essayist, poet, activist, and you're the mother of two daughters, and I heard you have a mean jump shot. You must be exhausted.
Well, you know, this is what we all do, right? This is the Portland
Not
way.
Not me. I sleep most of the day. Now, you earned your law degree at Georgetown Law Center, and you have an MFA in poetry from Pacific Lutheran University. That might seem an odd pairing, though not all that unique for poets. T.S. Eliot was a bank clerk. Wallace Stevens was an insurance executive. William Carlos Williams was a doctor, practicing doctor. What were your reasons for combining poetry and the law? How do you see them combined?
I guess I think we just are who we are when we show up, right? And, you know, you mentioned Wallace Stevens, who was an insurance executive, but he was also a lawyer. And it feels to me like, you know, law is somewhat of a literary experience where you really, you look hard at words, you're living in a world of words. And so it's not, to me, those things sort of intertwine themselves. Even though I'm not actively practicing law right now, it feels like the world of words is alive in all of those endeavors.
Yeah, I read in one of your print interviews, you were talking to another law student or a person who graduated law school and talking about how deadening some of the legal writing could be, and you even taught it for a time.
I did. Although there's some amazing writing in Supreme Court opinions. And I think, you know, over time, it's become more and more formulaic. But there, you know, you think even Supreme Court justices who I didn't necessarily agree with are some really fabulous writers.
Now, you were at KABU last week recording the show Poetry and Everything with host Judith Arcana. That will air, KABU listeners, on Monday, February 25th at 10 p.m. I'm assuming you focused on your two books of poetry in that interview. These Are Strange Times, My Dear, though, is your first collection of essays?
That's right.
And what goes into the decision to write an essay as opposed to a poem? What can you express in an essay you can't express in a poem, and I guess vice versa?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And there's one poem that's a sort of a companion to an essay in the last book of poems I published about Watergate. And I realized it was the telling of the story of me learning about Watergate. And the poem was it was from a child's point of view. So I learned about Watergate in the front seat of my mother's car, because you could do that then.
Oh, and that was listening to the news
to the
on the radio.
Yeah, listening to the radio.
1973 or so?
Yes. And uh-huh. So I was listening to it, and I realized that in the poem, the kind of jumps that a child's mind made was just very, it was very suited for that. Where in an essay, you sort of had to make, you know, eventually had to make sense of why it mattered to me.
And the essays in the book, I should mention they were written at various times. They were published in several journals before they were collected in the book. Did you see a common theme? Did you just collect pretty much all your essays? What was the selection process like to put the book together?
Yeah, there are published essays that are not in the book. And I would say about a third of the essays have not been published up to now. And I think I was starting to realize that I was really interested in this arc of how does one define oneself as a citizen? That was really the question. And that some of the essays that I'd written were really kind of circling around that question. And that some of the other essays weren't. And so that's sort of how the decision-making process happened. In my imagination, the title of the book was called Becoming Citizen. So the question is, you know, what did that take for me? And what does it take for all of us, right? To think we have very well identified, we have roles that as parents, we have roles as workers, we have roles as consumers, all these things that society tells us how to be. But, you know, our individual identities as citizens are not necessarily set out for us. And so that's what I was really interested in.
And I read in a previous interview, you purposely use the word republic here. The subtitle of the book is Field Notes from the Republic rather than from the nation, the country, the United States.
Yeah.
What was the reasoning for that?
I mean, I love the word republic. It's such a great word. But I also think some of it is writing from west, in some ways, writing from west to east, because if you're writing west, you should be writing in Japanese or Chinese or something. And so there's this way in which those of us who are writing in the West are always writing field notes, essentially, because the American identity is so heavily weighted to the East Coast. So I think in some ways it's always this sense of, let me tell you what's happening here. But I also think republic is aspirational, right? Like that we should be better than we are, and that we have a sense of what a republic, you know, what a constitutional republic should be. And so I like the idea that we're holding ourselves to some standard.
I've often heard, I hear it a lot now, especially given the last election where it was decided in the Electoral College and not by popular vote, that we're not a democracy, we're a republic. Are those two distant foreign concepts? It seems to me we are a republic with a democracy. I don't really see the exclusion between those.
I don't either. That conversation, though, I'm in that conversation sometimes. I don't find it all that interesting because I think as you say, even if we say, okay, fine, we're a republic, that we aspire to have democratic practices and a democratic culture. And so, you know, regardless of what our formal structures are, there is no question that we at least aspire to holding ourselves to this idea that the citizen voice matters. And when I say citizen, I love the word citizen, not as a legal matter and not as a whether you have legal status in some way, but rather as a way of saying this is the way that we get to be in community. This is the way we get to be in public.
So it's not really just the privileges that go with being a citizen, like voting and certain rights in the Bill. Well, you have your own Bill of Rights in the book and in one of the essays, a Gnostic Bill of Rights. But it's also the responsibilities we have as citizens.
Right. I think that's right. And I think some of the privileges are legally bestowed, but some of the privileges are we bestow them to one to another, right? That we make decisions in our own communities about how we're going to live together. And so that those are both privileges and rights, and we're granting them to each other.
Now, I talked about the subtitle of the book, of course, the use of the word republic there, Field Notes from the Republic. The book title itself, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, where does that come from?
That comes from a poem that I heard read in Persian, actually, at Alcatraz. This poet, Ahmad Shamlu, who I guess is a very famous poet in Iran, read this poem into the cell at Alcatraz. So Ai Weiwei did a big exhibit there, and you know, you would walk into cell and you'd hear Letter from a Birmingham Jail, or you'd hear Pussy Riot. There were all these people who had been incarcerated, and you could hear their voices in their own languages. And I was just so taken with this poem, even though I couldn't understand what was being said. And he had a beautiful voice, and I think he had passed away by then. And so then I went out into the hall where it was written down, and I copied it into my notebook in the translation in English.
Would you read that for? I just love the poem. You have an excerpt here in the title essay, I guess. These Are Strange Times, My Dear.
Yeah, I love this poem, and this is just an excerpt of the poem, and you can get it online, actually. So if people want to read it, they should read the whole thing because it's so incredible. And the first line is the title of the poem. In this dead-end street. In this dead-end street, they smell your breath, lest, God forbid, you said, I love you. They sniff at your heart. These are strange times, my dear. And they flog love by the side of the road at the barrier. Love must be hidden at home in the closet. In this crooked dead-end street, twisted with cold, they fuel their bonfire with poems and songs. Danger, don't dare think. These are strange times, my dear. They knock on the door in the night. The knock on the door in the night is someone who's come to snuff out the light.
Oh, my. That's kind of frightening.
Yeah.
And this was written, Ahmad Shamlu. So he was imprisoned?
I don't know that the poem was written while he was in prison, but he was, you know, he was one of the most well-known poets in Iran, and he was imprisoned.
And dissident.
Dissident, Iran. That's right, and was imprisoned off and on throughout his life.
Now let's talk about another well-known figure who plays a big part in the book. This is Václav Havel, the Czech writer, activist. Also, he was president of the country, wasn't he? He got elected. Now there's one essay in particular devoted to him, though I think his influence you feel throughout the book. The essay is called An All or Nothing Gamble. I wonder if you could talk about Havel's influence on the book, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, and on your other work.
I mean, Havel's a sort of a natural patron saint for me because he's both writer and activist and writer and democratic thinker. And so, you know, oddly, I actually traveled through Czechoslovakia in the fall, in the winter of 1989, not having any idea what was about to happen and just sort of by happenstance as a very young person. And so Havel was someone I really followed. And of course, he became well known worldwide when he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And he wrote an essay in the 1970s that became really famous, and it was passed
hand to hand throughout the sort of the Soviet bloc, called The Power of the Powerless. And what his thesis of in this essay was how you take power away from totalitarians and tyrants is by what he calls living in truth. Which, of course, right now is a really interesting question, right? What's true and what's
with
not
fake
true?
News, right? Yeah. Yes, and we get our truth from different sources.
Yeah, but his take was it was an internal truth. So to him it meant doing the thing that you're most compelled to do. And it could be writing poems or essays or plays, in his case, because he was a playwright.
So living your own truth,
right.
Bringing out who you really are
and
expressing
that. And being clear about it. Mm-hmm. And the example he uses is a greengrocer who, he says, you know, the greengrocer goes out and puts up the sign that says, "Workers of the World Unite," regardless of whether he ever thinks about the greengrocer. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether he ever thinks about the workers of the world. And the moment the greengrocer decides, I don't care about the workers of the world, you know, I care about radishes, and takes the sign down, that destabilizes totalitarians because they expect you to just fall in line both internally and externally.
Did you express this necessarily in the book then? Well, in your own personal truth, you play several roles. Again, I read in a previous interview, you're a Gemini, and you take that very seriously, kind of.
I live by it.
Yes, a split personality in many respects.
Yeah, and I think that's true of most of us, right? I mean, I think we've become pretty clear about defining our identities in really particular ways. But if we drill down to really know people and really talk with them and listen to them, that most everyone we know has many, many identities.
Now, as you say in the title of the book, "These Are Strange Times, My Dear," and we know it's from the poem. For many of us, these are also depressing times. What would you say to someone who's feeling a sense of hopelessness about the state of our country, our republic, mm-hmm. under the current administration?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because I feel that same feeling.
Is there
a lot.
An answer? I'd love to know.
Well, I
I'm among
there
them.
Are. I do think there are answers. I mean, I think one of the answers is to say, I don't know if you read Nick Kristof's piece in the Times right at the end of the of 2018, but he was like, the world is the best world we've ever lived in. Childhood mortality is going down. Lifespan is going up around the world. Hunger has gone down. Education's gone up. Literacy's gone up. So in a way, if we think about the world, more people are living in a better world than has ever been true on the planet. And one of the things that one of the big measures of the world is extreme poverty. And it used to be most of the world lived in extreme poverty. Most everyone lived in extreme poverty. And now it's 11%, which is still too many, but it's many fewer than there used to be. So I think we have a long ways to go, for sure. And we have to be vigilant, because it doesn't mean that just because we're here, we will stay here. But on the other hand, if you think, okay, there's a lot of things going right, how do we feed those things?
And I think you had a quote, again, in another interview, that as hopeless as things seem in the moment, they don't go on forever. One thing you just mentioned, I remember back in the Nixon days, and I would say Trump is worse, but he can't get away with as much as apparently Nixon did. I mean, they were killing kids in the street during Nixon. The National Guard killed 4 people at Kent State. There were people getting their heads bashed in. That's not going on now. It's not to say it may not be going on tomorrow or in a week or so, but things have been worse in this country.
And if you think about the fact that we have a civil war, that really the future of the country was incredibly uncertain. One of the things that President Obama, you know, always says is it's disrespectful to our ancestors, to the, you know, the civil rights ancestors, to say that things are worse than they've ever been, because it's not true.
Right. Certainly for people like Obama's ancestors, they're living in slavery.
Yes.
So things are a little better now.
Yeah.
Now, as we mentioned in the intro, in addition to your writing, you're executive director of Deliberative Democracy Consortium and the founder director of Oregon's Kitchen Table. I wonder if you can tell us, Wendy, a little bit about your roles in those organizations and what the organization's mission is.
Yeah, of course. So thank you for asking about that. Oregon's Kitchen Table is in the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. And the goal is really to get Oregonians' voices into public decision making. So we work with decision making bodies around the state, from state government down to, you know, counties and local governments, who are wanting to get to work with members of the public to hear what they think about, like, super detailed, gritty decision making. So it can be anything from a public budget to, you know, we've worked with people on water planning, and we look at we sort of look at the census data of a place, and we say, what are the communities that aren't heard very often in these decision making, and then we come up with strategies to help those voices come into the public decision making, whether they're voters or citizens or just got here yesterday.
And that's more local?
It's all state. It's in the state of Oregon,
where Deliberative Democracy Consortium is national.
That's right. And it's, you know, technically global, although mostly North American, but it's, that really is focused on what are the cutting edge practices in deliberative democracy around the world. And one of the things that's sort of heartening is, you know, even though we talk about a sort of democratic recession, there are all these practices happening in Australia and in Ireland and in Africa and many in Uganda. There's a great bunch of practices where the public voice is coming into decision making.
Can you give us some examples of that, again, to help us with our hopelessness
yeah.
here?
Well, I think a great example is Ireland. So Ireland just recently amended its constitution, which you probably heard about because it included legalizing some forms of abortion and gay marriage.
And which is very unusual for Ireland because it's basically a Catholic country, right. Very fundamentalist.
And
we didn't
know that they would ever be able to do that. And they did it through a really detailed public process where they had both a constitutional convention that included appointed people that were appointed by the parties, but also people who were randomly selected from off the street to come and get involved in the constitutional convention. And then following that, they did a citizen assembly where they had 100 randomly selected Irish citizens that came and studied the constitution for, I think it was 8 days over the course of a year, and then made recommendations on these constitutional amendments to their fellow voters. And then it went out to the vote. So people from Ireland keep writing these stories about Brexit, right? And saying, hey, you know, we've got some ideas for you on how you might involve the public in a really meaningful way.
And now, Wendy, where can our listeners find out more information about These Are Strange Times, my dear, and your upcoming events, including tonight's reading at Powell's on Hawthorne? That's at 7:30, I should mention.
Yes, there's a Powell's reading tonight, and then there are readings, in variety of places around the state of Oregon and in Washington over the next few weeks. And if you go to my website, I think it's pretty up to date, wendyraywillis.com. Ray is RAE, and there are some of the readings and upcoming events at that point.
Well, Wendy, thanks so much for joining us in KBOO. I'm sorry for the hassles with the weather and the parking here.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for your patience.
We've been talking with Wendy Willis, author of the new essay collection, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, Field Notes from the Republic from Counterpoint Press. Wendy will be reading at Powell's on Hawthorne tonight. You can catch her there at 7:30. There's time, and she'll be a guest on KBOO's Poetry and Everything show, hosted by Judith Arcana, on Monday, February 25th at 10 p.m. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the film screening of Making Waves, Rebirth of the Golden Rule, on Monday, February 11th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Making Waves, Rebirth of the Golden Rule is an award-winning documentary film. The Golden Rule is the peace boat that promoted the end of nuclear weapons testing in the Marshall Islands. Again, that's the film screening of Making Waves, Rebirth of the Golden Rule on Monday, February 11th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Buchan Hall at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium in Portland. Films showing this year include Mr. Soul, The Ballad of Shirley Collins, Solo, The Evolution of the One Man Band, Gospel According to Al Green, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the second annual Dance and Resist, Thursday, February 14th at 10 p.m. at Open Signal, Portland Community Media Center. Dance and Resist is Portland's only activist-led live television dance party. For Crying Out Meow Productions is proud to welcome back host and activist Kat Meow Garcia, joined this time by musician DJ Vicky for a night of resistance. Dance and Resist practices reclaiming community space through dance and revolutionary education. There will be a green screen photo booth, and costumes are highly encouraged. Again, that's Dance and Resist, too. Thursday, February 14th at 10 p.m. till midnight at Open Signal, 2766 Northeast MLK Jr. Boulevard, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium in Portland. Films showing this year include Mr. Soul, The Ballad of Shirley Collins, Solo, The Evolution of the One Man Band, Gospel According to Al Green, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio.